This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help understanding your animal's behavior, we want to hear from you. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls today, we'll also talk about another topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
We're going to talk about animal communicators.
Ooh.
Also known, some people call them pet psychics. We're going to discuss whether animal communicators are doing what they say they're doing. We're going to talk about whether we should write off any hope of understanding animal communication whatsoever. I don't think we need to do that.
But that's an interesting topic. And I'm sure in your many years of living and working with dogs, you have some pretty funny stories about your life with dogs,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, today we'll welcome a guest to the program whose new book shows that even celebrities aren't immune to curious canine behavior. So be sure to stay with us for that. First, let's take some calls at 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Barb calling from Hagerstown, Maryland.
Barb, thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
I have a 3-year-old African gray parrot named Scarlet, and she has become a member of our family very quickly. And the problem that we're experiencing is it started out probably when she was about 8 months old. We got her when she was 4 months old, and she started plucking her feathers on her chest.
Ooh.
And she has continued to do that for the last, 3 years or so.
Ooh.
We've had her tested. She doesn't have any diseases or anything. She's, knock on wood, absolutely healthy. It's just something that she does. If we could redirect her and have her play with her toys, then, she wouldn't be plucking. But she really doesn't play with her toys.
Ooh, that's very atypical. That's a big concern. You know, the first thing I was going to bring up was diet because, there's a very famous African gray. A lot of people know about Irene Pepperberg's Alex, very famous African gray parrot who basically learned to use English language, an incredibly impressive abilities to distinguish size and shape and abstract concepts like what's different and what's the same, what's bigger and what's larger. But Alex plucked his feathers for years, and Irene really struggled with it, particularly because she had to take videotapes of him performing.
Oh, sure.
It was a sort of naked parrot that looked really bad on 2020. So she actually discovered after years that it was a diet issue with Alex. He wasn't getting enough oil. So that's one of the things to look into is diet.
We do give her I think it's called red palm oil. So I don't think it's her diet. She really has a very well-rounded diet.
And she's getting oil, and that's really important.
That
was
oil.
One of the
yes.
factors. So good for you. The only good news is we can dismiss that as a possibility. It's good for other people to think about if they're in the same situation.
Right.
The fact that she doesn't play at all is very abnormal and atypical. Let me ask you this. Where did you get her from?
We got her from a woman who lives in Crownsville, Maryland.
And have you talked to her about the fact that she doesn't play with objects?
No, we really didn't go into that. We were more concerned. I guess we were more focused on the plucking.
Yeah, which is very understandable.
And then realizing, hey, she's not playing with her toys.
Right.
I wonder if you could ask the breeder about her other birds and if they...
The genetics?
If it's a genetic
something
thing?
In the line? Yeah, that's
well,
a good question.
When we discovered the plucking, I did call her and asked her, and she said none of her other birds have done this.
Let me ask you a question. Does Scarlet love food?
She's very spoiled, so she gets, whatever she wants whenever she wants it. So there's nothing really that she, has a burning desire to have.
Okay, try this. I would change that. So she has to work a little bit. And what I do is find objects and toys. There are lots of them. Boy, if you want to invest in a business, in a booming business, manufactured toys for caged birds. I mean, it's just, I want to buy them and I don't have a bird. They look so fun. So what I want you to do are buy toys that are parrot safe in which you can put food inside. And you're going to start giving her her favorite food only inside these little toys. So she has to pick them up, manipulate them with her beak in order to get the food out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's a way to start getting her to manipulate objects and toys, and it might make her a lot more playful in the long run. That would be what I would try next.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you very much for calling. That's a great idea. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. And Patricia, we had a question for you from Margo in Tallahassee, Florida, and this is about her cat. And here's what she writes. I adopted a one-year-old cat from the pound where I believe he's had his entire upbringing. Today he lives with another cat and an outside dog. Now that he's learned to go in and out of the cat door, he's begun to hunt. At first it was cockroaches, lizards, and moths. Then he brought in a dead one-pound rat. I scooped it up in the dustpan and threw it out in my backyard near the woods, but of course he found it and brought it back. How can I break him from bringing his prizes inside? Signed, sincerely, grossing out and fearing what's next in Tallahassee, Florida.
Oh, boy. You know, between a rock and a hard place, basically, how do you stop a cat from doing what how many millions of years of evolution has shaped a cat to do? You know, this is really hard. The only thing, well, cockroaches. I was going to suggest that cat bib, which a great listener of ours, we love it when the listeners give us wonderful ideas. And one of our listeners sent us an email about cat bibs, which were developed in Australia to prevent predation on birds, with some signs that it's actually pretty successful. However, I don't think it's going to work on a cockroach. Now, the only possibility of it working would be if it restricts the cat's movement and makes it a less effective predator. Now, the claim is, or the suggestion, is that the bib works on birds more because it serves as an alert to the birds rather than restricting the cat's movement, because they say cats can climb trees and they can do anything normally. So would this work on lizards? I don't think
so. Or on rats. You know, it's actually a little worrisome that the cat might be out there chasing after rats.
Rats bite.
Yeah,
and
that could
also
be a problem.
And they also carry a lot of ectoparasites, that some of them are secondary carriers of disease pathogens. So here's the bad news. Mm-hmm. The bad news is that if you're going to let your cat outside, cats hunt. That's just who they are. You can't take that out of a cat. Now, can you teach your cat to hunt outside and not bring prey inside? Tricky one. It's going to be a little tricky. There is a pet door that is like a garage door in that your cat would wear a little collar, and the collar on the cat would open or shut the door. But if they had a rat, for example, in
and it wasn't quite dead.
And it wasn't quite dead. The question is, would the door open for the cat with the rat? I think it would, because the rat would be in the cat's mouth. So I don't think that's going to work either. The best suggestion I have takes some time and some effort and some money, which is basically to build your cat a smaller enclosure outdoor. And it might want to have to have a roof on it so animals can't fly in. You may want to make sure your cat can't climb out. But basically, you could put all kinds of interesting environmental enrichment in there, particularly vertical surfaces. Cats want to go up high. So you could create this little outdoor screen porch or something, and you have vertical surfaces, you have natural-looking wood and things the cat can climb around and do without actually hunting, because it's screened and nothing can come in.
And you could do that on the lawn or even on a patio, I assume. Why not?
Yeah, you just need somebody to build it for you, and I'm sending Mueller down because he's a lot handier than I am.
Mr. Builder right here, ready to help and ready to take some more calls, too. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413, and here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Katya. I'm 9 years old, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. I was worried about my guinea pig. He seems to be very shy. He never really runs around a lot. Hmm. He usually stays in his little house. And he seems to be a whole lot better outside. Do you think we should get a hut for him?
Oh, I think that's a very good idea. You know, guinea pigs are prey animals, meaning that in the wild, guinea pigs are considered a delicacy by lots and lots of predators, by hawks and by ground-living canids. So they are hardwired to be really, really sensitive, especially to things looming over them. So one of the things that happens to guinea pigs a lot is their home is down low. Maybe the cage is on the floor, or maybe it's up at your sort of chest or shoulder height. But when you reach your hand in, a guinea pig's like, oh, here comes a hawk to bite me. Here comes something to eat me. And so it's very easy to make them fearful and shy. So a couple of things to think about. If he's better outside, then absolutely make a hutch for him. Make sure it's safe. Give them lots of hidey places. One of the things you also want to do with any species that's fearful is to let them come to you. It takes a lot of patience. This is a great exercise in patience for a person of any age.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I think 9-year-olds are more patient than adults often. So this is a great project for you. What I want you to do is I want you to reinforce your guinea pig every time he comes towards you and comes out a little bit. So the way you would do that is not by reaching towards him or her. The way you do that is find something your guinea pig really, really loves, maybe some food that's your favorite food. You can experiment. Take a couple of days to find out what your guinea pig loves the most. And that's easy. You can just put 3 different kinds of food right where the guinea pig usually eats and see what gets eaten first.
First, you know? First thing to go.
Yeah, and just keep experimenting and find food number one, you know?
Okay.
But, you know, there's one other thing I would love you to try. We know quite a bit about guinea pigs, and they have a whole set of vocalizations, and they have a whistle. Go online and look it up and get a recording of this guinea pig whistle that's used as a kind of a contact call. And you learn that whistle, and maybe you and the guinea pig can whistle back and forth.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
What's your guinea pig's name?
Mo.
Well, I tell you what, say hi to Mo from us.
Okay.
And thank you very much for calling, Katya.
And let us know how it goes, okay?
Will you call us back and let us know how it goes?
Okay.
Thank you, honey.
Bye.
Well, that's great to hear from some of our younger listeners, isn't it?
Oh, I love it. I hope she calls back.
I do, too. And, well, young and old, you can call us at 1-800-462-7413. And, by the way, people can send us questions, too. Email us questions, too, can't they, Patricia?
Oh, we love it. It's really easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And here's a question for you. How far would you go to try to understand what your pet is thinking? Good question, eh? Coming up next, we'll talk about whether animal communicators are the answer. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and it's time for this week's topic, Patricia. And what are we talking about today?
Well, you know, we get a lot of interesting emails, and we got an interesting one from Jeff in Chilton, Wisconsin, who wanted to know what I thought about pet psychics.
Ah.
And it's a really good question. You know, I thought we should take some time to talk about it.
So what do you think of pet psychics, or I guess a lot of people would call them animal communicators?
Animal communicators, yeah. Well, the first thing I want to say is that, boy, do I understand why people are attracted to them. There's so many times we want to know what's going on, you know, in our animal's brain. But I have to tell you, I do have a lot of skepticism, partly because the situation is so ripe for abuse. You know, how do we call them accountable? How can you know they're wrong? Your dog is thinking this. And so there's no way for us to really know if they're doing what they say they're doing. And so I suspect, frankly, that a lot of people who call themselves pet psychics or animal communicators aren't really doing what they say they're doing. And also, sort of along the same lines, as a scientist who talks about, I mean, we're arguing right now whether animals have consciousness or not, whether animals like our pets, you know, not cockroaches, but mammals like our dogs and cats. I'm actually firmly in the camp that indeed they do. They have rich emotional lives. But it's really hard to imagine the mechanism. You know, how does this work? How could a person, this is often done by telephone, by the way.
Yeah.
So how could a person, at one part, you know, on one side of the country, on a telephone, tap into the mind of somebody's dog. It really does seem pretty far out of the box to me.
Yeah. Have any of your clients ever had experience with animal communicators?
You know, quite a few of my clients have. And I have to tell you, I've had mixed results. I've had some clients who came in and the communicator said, your dog is aggressive because your dog doesn't like other dogs. And I was like, yeah, that was worth $150. But I have had cases that were truly astounding. Cases that were really, really amazing. And so I'm going to go on record right now as saying I am not willing to dismiss that this is possible. You know, science is full. We have a long history of poo-pooing all kinds of ideas because we couldn't imagine a mechanism for it. But then it turned out to be something that was possible. So
yeah, and you know, and sometimes certain things simply can't be explained.
That's right. That's right. And maybe they can be later. And a good science to look at is physics. I mean, look at physicists. They're some of the most medical, physical people you can talk to. They are the first to talk about the existence of forces that we don't even begin to understand. So even though I can't imagine the mechanism, I have seen in some cases it be helpful. And I think it's really important to be open-minded. You know, we're starting to learn so much more about the power of the unconscious and the power of the mind. And a lack of understanding something does not mean it can't work.
Thank you, Patricia.
You're welcome.
And this idea, as you mentioned, came from Jeff in Wisconsin. And we hope that if you have a topic idea for us, that you will join in. And what the heck, go to our website at callingallpets.org and send us that topic idea. You can do it right on the website, and we'd love to have it. And as we have just proven, we will take ideas from our listeners and use them on the air. So we hope you'll do that. And we hope you'll call with your questions, too, at 1-800-462-7413. And as a matter of fact, another caller is with us right now. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello there. This is Mike from Mequon, Wisconsin.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was looking for a little guidance regarding my wonderful little dog, Toby, who is a King Charles Cavalier. He's about 2.5 years old, and he's been exhibiting a bit of a behavior problem that seems to be getting a little bit worse over the years. Now, we moved here from Michigan about a year and a half ago, so I don't know if that had anything to do with it. But the problem is his relationship with any another dog. When he sees a dog, though, out the window of the car, he begins to go berserk. No matter how large another creature, he will pretty much almost like he's losing his mind.
Sure.
And he's the most wonderful little dog.
We hear you. You love your Toby. We love your Toby, too. And listen, I don't want you to feel badly. I have a year-and-a-half-old border collie who at 7 weeks started the same behavior. At 7 weeks of age.
7 weeks.
7 weeks of age. I literally looked at him and thought, I am so doomed. Luckily, I had a lot of ideas about what to do. And I got to tell you, he's doing really, really well. So there are a lot of different things you can do. I'm going to pick one and talk about it at length. But it's just one thing to do. The other thing I want you to do is to jump online, go to Calling All Pets website, and you can find some booklets that specifically deal with this. But let me talk about one easy, specific way to handle this that is relatively easy but not intuitive.
Okay.
What you're going to do is, first of all, try setting up situations where you have some control over the behavior of that other dog. So that means sitting down with your family and going, okay, who do we know who has a dog who's not super reactive to other dogs and who's and the human of the pair follows directions? So this will eliminate 2/3 of your friends.
All right. Or 90%.
Right. Or 90%. Larry's more of a – I'm an optimist. Larry's a realist. Right. What friends, right? So you got three people who fit this description and who have the time and the willingness to help you. You are going to stage manage where they are. And the best thing to stage manage is to create a situation where either you're in an area where you know there are no other dogs, maybe somebody's big, huge yard, maybe an area where it's really early in the morning and nobody else is going to be there. And you're going to ask them to stand with their dog, like, by the oak tree. And that's 100 yards away from where you're going to appear. And they're just going to stand still because you want that other dog standing still because part of what freaks out dogs is when another dog is walking straight at them. You know, if you look at all the research on dog behavior, dogs never greet unfamiliar dogs by walking straight into each other, and that's what sidewalks do. We actually create a lot of this because of this direct head-on approach, dogs on a leash, two dogs walking towards each other. Dogs would never walk that way. If you videotape, watch dogs in the wild, they do this sort of semicircular, sort of bend around in a semicircle. So they avoid that kind of to them, it's a confrontation. So you want that other dog to be standing still because it avoids at least some of that that's going to set your dog off too badly. So you're going to be walking down the sidewalk, and you know when your dog is first going to see this other dog, and you're going to be ready. And what you're going to do is the microsecond that other dog is in view, you're going to say, "Let's go," or "About turn," a little cue that's sort of punchy, and you're going to instantly turn and go the other way. You're going to do a 180. And you're just going to whip around and go the other way. And if your dog barks because he sees the other dog, you hear nothing, you see nothing. You know, and luckily, even though it's a big King Charles, hey, it's, you know, not a Great Dane, right? It's a King Charles, you know, right?
He thinks he's larger.
But you really are bigger in this case. So you're just going to do a 180, and you're going to clap your leg, and you're going to have that treat in your hand, and you're going to give Toby that little treat as soon as he's two strides away from the other dog. So to summarize, here's what's happening. Is they start learning. They've been conditioned to learn an incompatible behavior. And it can be very, very effective. So
give that
there
a shot,
you go.
Too. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sharon.
Sharon, where are you calling from?
Ketchum, Idaho.
Ketchum, Idaho. Well, thank you very much for calling. And what's on your mind?
I have two Goldens. One is a year and a half. I got him from the shelter here at 7 months. And he, when he goes to the bathroom, turns around and eats it.
And that bothers you?
No. He also eats the other Goldens.
Autocoprophagia, it's called. It is a truly disgusting habit. I had a dog, Scott. Scotty did the same thing, and it's about the grossest. Sorry, for everybody who's listening, we're so sorry. It's just what it is. Do keep in mind that eating feces is a natural behavior for a dog. Not eating their own, but eating feces is a natural behavior for a dog. I think I've mentioned before on the show that the Navajo word for dog is to live on a Navajo Indian reservation. And the Navajo, learned a little Navajo, the Navajo word for dog is hlisha, although I might be pronouncing that incorrectly, hlisha, which means eater of horse poop.
He does that too.
Of course.
He'll eat anything.
The best. So, but when it gets to eating their own, it's just beyond the pale, right? So here are a couple of things you can do. There are some additives you can try. I don't know if you've tried them all. There's some sort of general commercial products you can try. I, too, have never seen much success with those. But there's some products that are generally sold as supplements, as digestive supplements, Prozyme or Kazyme. It's a set of enzymes that actually are supposed to aid digestion. And I have never understood why it's worked on 50% or so of the coprophagic dogs that I've worked with. Does it make the poops taste bad? Maybe. Or does it increase nutrition so the food that comes, you know, a lot of dogs, so their intestinal tract isn't absorbing enough nutrition, so what comes out is still pretty darn good food, basically. So I don't know why it works on so many dogs, but it's something you might want to look into and you might want to try. Other thing I would do, besides the obvious, everybody says the obvious, well, pick up really well. You know, when they're doing it, you know.
And whipping around.
When they're doing it as they're doing it, it can get really tough.
On top of them, yes.
And it can start to make your dog afraid of you. You know, you're yelling, you're running at him. I really sympathize with you. This is not an easy one. Here's what I would do. I would not worry about correcting it because it's probably not working. It just makes your relationship degrade. Mm-hmm. What I would work on is teaching the old incompatible behavior routine. But so here's the question. So much of the advice is very similar, but the way you do it is always different, you know? So teach an incompatible behavior. I talk about that all the time. But so here's the question for the listeners. What incompatible behavior would you teach your dog if your dog did it? You know? So we need to know more about your dog. You know, what does your Golden love to do? Fetcher, a retriever?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a retriever.
All right. So you're going to go out with his favorite
tennis ball or whatever it is, and you're watching him like you always do, like a hawk anyway. You're already trained to do that, right? And he goes, and the microsecond that little butt stuff starts to come off the air, you go, what's his name?
Bear.
Bear. And you throw the ball. And you might even throw it right, you know, like at him. I don't want you to scare him. But you throw it so he can't miss it. There's a ball there. So you're simply going to teach him, as soon as I'm done, I need to look to her because she's going to throw the ball. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. So this is might not be the perfect idea for Bear. You know, you have to customize this. And anybody out there who has a similar problem, ask yourself, what can most motivate my dog to go away from that pile and do something else? That'll make sense?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate the call very much. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Patricia, a few weeks ago, we invited listeners to share their thoughts about why cats purr. Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, we heard from Ingrid in Falls Church, Virginia, who says she was always of the understanding that purring is primarily for soothing and or comforting. For example, a nursing queen purrs to reassure her kittens, let them know that all's well. She also thinks purring may be a display of love or affection or a form of self-comfort when a cat is distressed. So that's her view. We also heard from a listener named Sharon, who had a Burman cat for 10 years named Unky. And when Unky started to purr, sometimes he'd seem startled by the sound and stop immediately.
And, that's such a funny image.
And Sharon discovered later that he'd learned to purr silently. And she goes on to say, even though I couldn't hear him purr, I could place my fingers on his throat and feel the vibrations of purring. So my advice is don't give up if it seems your cat doesn't purr. Maybe your cat is a silent purr ball like my sweet Unky.
I love that idea. That's a really, really good tip. And you know, back to why they purr, I totally buy into the possibility that purring is about possibly soothing another, maybe your kittens, or comforting yourself. You know, we all do a lot of things to comfort ourselves. But here's the big but. There are cats who purr when they're in great distress. And so maybe they're making that to soothe themselves, you know, consciously or unconsciously. That's a possibility. There was some research on that a while back, and I need to go back. I'm going to go back and look at that, and we'll talk about it on another show. And I don't remember the results as well as I wish. I'm getting so old.
Well, we'll bring it up on another show.
Yeah, I'll go look for it, and I'll bring it back on another show.
And how do people send us their pet tips?
Oh, we love to hear from you. We get such great ideas. Send us an email. It's easy. Just send it to pets@wpr.org.
And coming up next, Howell, along with the co-founder of the Bark magazine, as we celebrate the hilarity of life with dogs. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Cameron Wu to the program. Cameron is the co-founder and publisher of The Bark magazine, and he's also the co-editor of a new book. It's called Howl, a collection of the best contemporary dog wit, featuring a collection of essays highlighting the hilarity of life with dogs. And I think there's something like 68 different stories in this book. Cameron, welcome to the program. 68 stories, but you had, I bet, many more than 68 stories you could have used. How did you decide which stories to include in this book?
Well, it was a challenge because everyone has a funny story about their dog. And, you know, after our first book, Dog Is My Co-Pilot came out, we were looking for a second project and really thought that, you know, it was time to add some levity to our tome of work. So we started contacting some of our favorite writers, our humor writers, and the work started pouring in. So, you know, we tried to set people on a certain course, but when you work with writers, you can throw out some ideas, but really they're going to write about what hits home to them.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right about that. And Dave Barry and all kinds of people.
Yeah. Mark Spitz and...
Kinky Friedman, Megan Daum, Phil Austin, you know, Al Franken. We were fortunate to catch Al between speeches. So a lot of good people in there.
Well, there are a lot of good people and a lot of good stories and a lot of funny ones in there. What are the ones that you relate to the most? Tell us some of the ones that just really got you.
Well, Kinky Friedman has a piece in there about the challenges of sleeping with your pet companions. And we have that challenge every night because we have cats, we have dogs, and we all kind of struggle for our piece of the bed. So it's quite humorous. I think people who've shared a night with a pet will relate to that. You know, the material comes from unexpected places, and while most of the pieces do come from names people will recognize, there are some pieces that you know, people will scratch their head and not recognize the name. And one of the pieces that falls in that category was a submission that came to us a few years ago from two professors that took a hilarious take on what life would be like if people were dogs. So he examines a dog... a dinner party if attended by dogs.
Oh, that is one of the funniest things ever written about dogs.
Yeah, I think one of the keys to humor is taking that seed of truth and then putting it into an absurd context.
You know, one of the things I enjoyed about the book, and I'll use the Mark Spitz story as an example. Now, here's Mark Spitz, who's a rock music critic, and he's an edgy kind of a guy who lives in New York City and suddenly winds up with a dog, and that dog totally changes his life.
Yeah, that was one of the things that we tried to do. We wanted to bring some fresh voices into the mix, and we were happy to hook up with people like Mark Spitz, like you said, as a rock music critic and wrote a book on Green Day. So he has a different take on dogs. In fact, his dog is named Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
And... there's a piece, just a sentence or two from that piece. It says, "Nothing blows your cool worse than worrying about your loved ones." And if you're of a certain age or a certain kind of take on life, I think people can relate to that.
Yeah. Your book even helps us understand the difference between your mom and your dog.
that's a distinction many of us
just
have suffered.
Just in case we can't tell who's who, what are some of those differences?
Henry Alford wrote this essay. And he strikes upon some of the similarities and then some of the differences in case you sometimes get confused between your mom and your dog. Let's see, a couple of the similarities. Both are responsible for the proliferation of small oval area rugs. Both are sometimes asked to stay indoors due to an inability to mix well with others. Fortunately, he gives us some differences so that we can achieve that goal of keeping mom away from our dog in terms of in our mind. And one is that mom's interested in portion control and your dog is not interested in portion control, a major difference.
Very true. Unless your mother's Italian, it's like, eat, eat, eat everything you can. Well, you know, something about dogs that can make some of us a little crazy. You even say at Bark Magazine that you have a way to determine if someone is suffering from crazy dog person syndrome. How can we tell? What are the symptoms of crazy dog person syndrome?
Well, you know, there's a test that... Lee, our the author of Rex in the City, who's been writing for Bark for about 5 years, she came up in her essay with some a simple test. And a few things that she asks is, when asked a simple question such as, how are you, do you, A, say, fine, thank you, and you? Two, say, fine, thank you, and then tell the person who inquired how your dog is? Or three, immediately launch into an extended monologue in which you prattle on about the consistency of your dog's stool. So she has lots of little questions, Q&A, and you can take this test and then rate yourself. And if you score at a certain level, then, well, you have to admit it, you're a crazy dog person. But I confess, I've taken a few of these questions here, and I won't share the answers. It's a little embarrassing.
Oh, we know. We know the answer, Cameron. They teach us a lot of biology, don't they?
They learn
a lot of biology when you have
a
pet.
I hate to ask this, but I will anyway. Do you have a favorite story in your book?
A favorite story? Well, there's a couple of them. Haven Kimmel contributed a piece, a longer piece. And it's more of a – almost reads like a short story, and it's an account of her traveling several hundred miles to pick up a dog that she saw online and rescue this little Chihuahua mix.
It's a great
Quite
story.
Quite hilarious if you don't know her work. And then the book ends with another favorite piece by Megan Daum. And Megan writes for the L.A. Times, and someone suggested that we should ask her to write something. She did. And it was brilliant. It wasn't nearly as funny, and I say that in quotes, as some of the other pieces, but it was so good and so kind of captured what Bark is about and what we feel is on the minds of dog people today that we had to include it. So it's the piece that closes the book.
Cameron, why do you think we continue to find dogs so funny?
Well, part of it certainly goes back to our long history together. And, you know, whether you say it's 50,000 or 100,000 years since this friendship and bond began, you know, I think that dogs are probably there, you know, when our first joke was told, you know, maybe it was like two dogs walk into a cave. But I think more than that, it's this lack of natural boundaries that we have with dogs and our attempts and sometimes failed attempts to define some boundaries, whether it be physical or behavioral or emotional. And it's that struggle, that give and take, often at an absurd level, as some of the things you've mentioned, that I think is just great, you know, food for laughter. And besides the fact that dogs have great timing. So in a sense, anyone who's had a dog knows that dogs are really quite good comedians.
They really are. And Cameron, I thank you very much for being with us. We both thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Cameron Wu is the co-editor of Howl, a collection of the best contemporary dog wit, and he joined us today from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. Maybe you have an amusing question for us. If you do, or any question, as a matter of fact, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413, and here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Caroline from Frisco, Texas.
Caroline, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, we have two family cats, and one of them, his name is Ricky. He's about maybe 18 months old or so. He has this very bizarre behavior. We have a water dish that is like the, you plug it in and the water constantly pumps through and fountains down.
Yeah, good
yeah,
for you.
I had one of those.
You did.
Well, we got this water dish and he kind of will attack it. Like he'll dig at it and move it across the floor and spills water everywhere and he wraps his body around it and puts his shoulder down on the floor and kind of, and it's just a very odd thing, and we're trying to figure out what to do because he does make a big mess.
I want a video of this.
Yeah. I can see him swatting away at that running water. Does he do that?
No, not it's not the water. It's like the whole thing. He just pushes it across the floor, and then if I'm cleaning it at the filter, he'll pull the filter out with his teeth and drag that all around.
You know, it might be related to the sound. I mean, there are a couple of different stimuli that could stimulate your cat to go after it. But, you know, we know from research that cats have a different acoustic sensitivity than we do. They're keyed to hear sounds higher than we are. It's possible, you know, all those machines have little sounds associated with them, and it's actually possible that, one, the sound of the motor or whatever electrical parts are actually getting this water to move around stimulates him, even possibly bothers him, you know? So he may be treating it as a prey animal. It's possible
right.
that there's a high-pitched sound that's acting him to try and get after the little mouse that's hidden inside the machine. Or he may be, it's perfectly possible that he hates the sound. It's like, shut this thing up. And he's trying every way he can think of to get the noise to go away. So that if he's not attending to the moving water, which is Larry's idea, was a very good one. A lot of cats, obviously, they're predisposed to pay attention to moving things, and I can imagine him swatting at the water. But if it's not that, I'm wondering if it might be the sound. What you might want to consider is adding a tiny little bit of flavor, maybe meat flavor, to the water. So basically, you would take some nice fresh water. You're going to want to change this every day. And you're going to just drop a little tiny bit of beef broth or...
In another bowl, you're saying now, not the running water bowl?
I would try eliminating the running water. Exactly, Larry. Try just giving that... Put that baby away for a little bit since it's driving you all crazy. And just try a regular bowl of water, but make it more attractive by having a tiny little flavor of something really wonderful in it. See if that helps.
Okay.
Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Stay with us. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Howl, a collection of the best contemporary dog wit by Cameron Wu. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time now for our animal trivia question of the week. If you think you know the answer to this week's question, call our 800 number or send us an email to pets@wpr.org. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of Howl by the editors of Bark Magazine. And here's today's question. One dog that's kept us laughing over the years is Snoopy. Snoopy has starred in the comic strip called Peanuts for over 57 years, and when Charles Schulz first created the Peanuts comic strip, the original drawings of Snoopy were based on his two childhood dogs. Name one of Charles Schulz's childhood dogs.
Hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, you only need to guess one name to be correct, and if you think you know the answer, call our 800 number or send an email to pets@wpr.org. And to find out if you're correct, visit callingallpets.org, and we'll have the correct answer posted online in about a week. And I tell you what, we've got some callers online, Patricia. Let's take a call, should we?
I'm ready.
Here's the number, by the way, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi.
Who are we speaking with?
George.
George, where are you from?
Dallas.
Dallas, Texas. Well, George, what's on your mind?
Well, I have three dogs. One is much older, just Mutt. I got him at a center where he was abused, and I've had him for many, many years. And I have another, a Papillon. He's 10. And I just recently got another Papillon, a female, and she's a year old now. And she, for some reason... Whenever I'm in the room and I'm just sitting there watching TV and everything, they're laying in bed and it's fine. If I get up and go to the kitchen, when I come back to the room, she just barks like crazy, like she doesn't know who I am, and she backs away.
Ooh.
And then after a few minutes, she's fine again.
So does she bark the same way to strangers when they come into the home?
Yes.
Okay.
Pretty much. And she like, you know, she like backs up for a minute and then she's fine.
You know, this is such an interesting phenomenon. I had a similar kind of case. It was actually a dog that I took into my home. I very rarely do this, but it was a border collie. He'd bitten three times. He was owned by the sweetest elderly Catholic Irish priest who was he was out of central casting, except nobody hired him because he looked like a stereotype. He was this darling little gray-haired man with rosy cheeks and twinkly blue eyes, and he had this border collie who bit people. And so it was either euthanize the dog, but I took him, and the reason I'm bringing this dog up is that he was very aggressive to strangers, but I got him so he was doing very well with my guy, Jim, except... After about 4 days, we were inside the house, we were all friends, everything was fine. We all walked outside, all together. The dog turned around, looked at Jim as if he'd never seen him before, and almost bit him. And so it was like, I recognize you in this context, but I do not recognize you in that context. And I've seen quite a few clients who had the same problem. Usually not with their owner, though. It's usually, Larry, with a visitor who comes, and the dog is uncomfortable, but the dog settles down, greets the person, everything's okay, but then the person leaves the room, comes back in, and it's like they've never seen them before. There's some neurobiological glitch that I don't get. You know, how is this happening? I can tell you what to do. I can't tell you exactly how this is happening, but I can tell you what to do.
That's all I want.
And this is relatively easy for you to do because you have control of your comings and goings. And you have a little dog who probably likes – what is your little young Papillon like? Does she like food? Does she like toys? What makes her really happy?
Basically, what really makes her happy is her cookies. She likes her cookies.
She loves her cookies. So what I want you to do is for a while, whenever you can, put the other dogs in another room, put them in their crates, give them little stuffed toys to chew on. And what I want you to do is I want you to go in and out of your living room 30 times in a row, but every time you come in, you're preceded with little tiny bits of wonderful food that you're going to toss. You're just going to underhand toss them. And what you want her to learn is that your step towards that room when you're re-entering the room is a precursor or a predictor to her getting something she loves. So this is a classical counter-conditioning kind of paradigm where you're teaching her, I love it when he comes back. I want her to be like, yee-haw, I love the food. I love him. So try that and let us know how it goes, okay?
Thanks, George.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, George. Appreciate your call. You know, as you were talking, and it really would be interesting to know that what goes on in a dog's mind, you know, to get into that kind of situation.
It would. And, you know, one possibility with these dogs is I wonder about their eyesight. You know, dogs have great senses of smell, but smell only works if the wind is blowing from the object or the person to the dog. So if the air current is going the other way, the dog's not going to be able to use smell. There is actually, you know, there's a researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Dr. Murphy, who has looked at quite a few dogs and has found in some breeds, German Shepherds, for example, there's a very, very high percentage of eyesight problems. A lot of German Shepherds are nearsighted. And so, you know, so this might explain maybe the dog literally has an eyesight problem. I think a lot of these problems are sensory related. Maybe the dog can't see well and literally doesn't recognize him when he comes back in. I mean, that's probably the best first guess anyway.
But, you know, in some ways, it's kind of like your car. If your car breaks down, you'd like to know why. But really, if the mechanic can fix it and get it fixed.
Absolutely.
That's enough. And it runs. Sometimes that has to be enough.
And, you know, I don't even really care why, frankly. I deeply care why animals are doing what they do. I have to admit. But you know what? I just want my car to run. I do. I admit it hereby.
Tell you what, we've got a great story here. We received an email from Lori in Wasilla, Alaska, who wanted to share a story about her fish. And this is really cool. Talk about figuring out what's going on in something's mind.
Yeah.
Here's what she writes. I've had an African cichlid for about 6 or 7 years now. He shares a large tank divided by a plastic net to keep him away from the other fish so he won't eat them. And as you probably know, this type of fish is a constant excavator and is always digging up the gravel in his tank. One day, I looked toward the tank and saw him on the wrong side of the net chasing the smaller fish.
Uh-oh.
As I rushed toward the tank, he saw me coming and ducked under the net back to his side of the tank. To this day, I'm convinced that he knew he wasn't supposed to be there. I know he can think and reason, but what do you think?
Oh, no, that's a great question. The first question I have is, do we really know this is a he? A lot of female fish build nests in the ground on the substrate. They rearrange rocks. Now, in some species, males do it too, and I have to hereby admit, Larry, I do not know the cichlids. There are many species of cichlid, and I don't know if it's the males or the females. So we call it he
okay,
for our purposes, but who knows if it's a he or a she. But there is no question that this fish has learned a pattern of behavior. And this is trivial. You can teach amoebas. You can teach single-cell animals that we know do not have a brain. You can teach them a consequence to a stimuli. So something happens, and the individual learns, whether consciously or not. You know, you can learn a lot unconsciously, and we're actually starting to learn about how much of human behavior is unconscious, is subconscious. It's really interesting and a little scary and fascinating. But so you don't have to have a conscious working brain to learn that every time you go on the other side of the net, something is going to happen that's aversive. So when that thing starts to happen, then you quick get yourself on the right side of the net. There is no question a fish can do that. That actually is relatively trivial. So you are not attributing abilities to your fish that you shouldn't attribute. Now, is this a conscious thought out strategy?
No.
No, there's the, you know, there's the controversial part. Now the trick is, like, who's training who faster? You know, he's going to get better at finding ways to get over there and then get back before you even knew he was there.
I love stories like this. Let's have people send more of those stories.
Oh, we love getting them. You can send us an email to pets@wpr.org. Go on our website. You can read some great stories, callingallpets.org.
And we hope you'll join us again next week, by the way, Patricia and I. Patricia is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0405P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.